Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man of uncommon intelligence, whose brains we get to pick each week, I'm pleased to say, is David Goldman. He is a contributor to the Asia Times under the byline Spengler. Absolutely brilliant columns there. He is the author of a new book, You Will Be Assimilated, which is tremendously timely and important because it talks about, well, the topic we visit with him about most weeks, which is what communist China is up to, specifically in the battle space of, well, technology and industrial policy and the competitions that flow from that, including those of direct bearing on our national security. David, it's very good to have you with us as always. Welcome back. Let me ask you about tech war. This is the subject, I think, of your most recent column at Asia Times. It's also a feature, of course, of your new book. We're in one, I think it's fair to say, with China. How would you characterize that war at the moment? Who's winning, who's losing, and what are the prospects going forward?
We're playing a war of attrition that looks like whack-a-mole with Huawei and other Chinese entities that we consider a threat to the United States. No country in the world has ever succeeded over the long term, not even medium term usually, in preventing a competitor from acquiring and using advanced technology. And what we're trying to do at the moment is to deny access by Huawei and other Chinese entities to top line American chips or chips made by the Taiwanese or Koreans using American chip making equipment and so forth. In response to which, the Chinese are putting hundreds of billions of dollars into building up their own internal capabilities. And this creates a real dilemma for the United States because our great technology companies, the NVIDIAs, the Qualcomms, the Intels, and so forth, sell between three quarters and fourths of their total product stream to Asia, of which China is by far the biggest buyer. They depend on the Chinese market. Without that, it won't exist. The Chinese, among other things, buy our semiconductors. They package them into smartphones, tablets, and computers, and they're our main providers. Our trade deficit with China is close to a record right now. Chinese exports to the U.S. are back up to the pre-tariff peak because we need so many electronic goods because of the lockdown. Every school kid needs a computer. As you know, it's hard to find them, so we're importing massively from China. It's very difficult to break that web. And if the Chinese are able to break our monopoly on chip design, semiconductor equipment, and even chip fabrication, their intention, and I've been told this by very placed Chinese sources, is to put America's tech companies out of business. They're not going to survive. And that's the game where that's the stakes we're fighting on right now.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it's a Hobson's choice here, David. It sounds as though we continue providing what's not just a competitor, but an enemy, I believe, in communist China, the technology with which to build more and better stuff, which will probably put us out of business in due course. Or we tried not to sell them the stuff that enables them to do that in the near term at the risk of having them build a capability to produce it themselves and then put us out of business. Am I missing a third way here?
Well, the third way is, for example, the Chinese have spent more than $600 billion in the last 10 years subsidizing their domestic semiconductor industry. If we keep ahead in technologies which are beyond their capacities and turn all of that stuff into the equivalent of an 8-track tape player, the Communist Party of China will have sunk $700 billion into the ground and get nothing out of it. So staying ahead technologically, dominating the advances, the innovations, gives us the ability to leave them trailing behind us. Whatever they have, we'll have something better. Now, there have been proposals coming around Congress to match the Chinese. Chinese Communist Party proposed a $1.4 trillion tech subsidy program in May, last National People's Congress. That's a lot of money. We've been talking about maybe a $200 billion scientific subsidy bill over the next 5 years called Infinite Frontiers. Nowhere in Congress, semiconductor industry has talked about a $25 billion subsidy program. That's gotten nowhere. And meanwhile, we hardly fabricate chips in the U.S. We do the designs. We've got the best design companies in the world. But we have to go to Taiwan and Korea to get the chips made. Now, it's not secure because one engineer in Chinese pay sitting in a Korean or Taiwanese factory can put a backdoor among the 10 billion transistors in a state-of-the-art chip that will allow it to self-destruct, for example, by remote control. And that's what our military is using. So that's the very worrisome things.
So what you've described, not least in You Will Be Assimilated, is a vision of a serious, well, technology competitiveness strategy. The term industrial policy has been given a pretty bad name, but I think maybe that's what it is at the end of the day. And it's not just a question, I assume, David Goldman, of pouring lots more money in. Maybe we can't match them dollar for dollar, but maybe we don't need to. But we do need to put lots more in than $25 billion here or $25 billion there. But are you aware of technologies that we should be pursuing with that money that we're not, that might make this difference, that might actually restore and enable us to maintain our competitive edge?
There are a dozen different ways where computer chips might become many times faster than they are now. Quantum computing is the most obvious one. Whoever wins the race to quantum computing will be able to crack any code that anyone can devise in a matter of seconds. They'll be able to design new aircraft or drones in a matter of minutes. The possibilities are incredible for industrial design, cryptography, every other artificial intelligence, every other application you could mention. In terms of the chip making itself, there are ways to use light instead of electrical signals to get much higher degrees of efficiency. There are new materials that could be much more efficient than silicon, which is what chips are based on. There's a huge variety of them that you don't want to advance what's going to work. And the reason a public-private partnership works so well is because the entrepreneurs are not going to take the risk of the unknown unknowns in terms of basic physics. That's the kind of stuff you need a Bell Labs to do, working off Defense Department contracts. We don't really have much of that anymore.
Thanks in part, I think it must be said, because the Chinese have eaten our lunch in that regard, buying up a lot of those companies, among other things.
Our great tech companies decided to outsource their manufacturing to Asia, China, as well as, of course, Korea and Taiwan.
And this is one of the things, David, we're just hard out of time. I need to come back with you on, because this is so vital to sort of retooling where we are today and where we need to go for the future. We will talk about that in the near future. Thank you for your time today, my friend. Come back to us again soon, if you would. Next up, we speak with Jeff Nyquist about challenges at home and abroad right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back for one of the real high points of our weekly programming here at Secure Freedom Radio, our visit with J.R. Nyquist, known to his friends as Jeff. He is an essayist par excellence. You can find his writings at jrnyquist.blog. You can also see them in outstanding publications like Epic Times. But I want to particularly commend to you all his new book, The Fool and His Enemy. And we're going to catch up with him about several things that are taking place out on the West Coast, or Left Coast, as some of us call it, where he currently resides. Jeff, it's good to have you with us. Welcome back. You've posted a piece about how you're actually leaving the Left Coast on your blog, and I know partly that's due to the fires that are now raging all around you and turning the sky orange. But what else is prompting you to make this move? And what does it say about the state of California at the moment?
Well, the state is very, very left wing. And of course, it's not just a matter of taxes. The state's San Francisco, I mean, the homeless problem, just to, for one, I had a friend from San Francisco. I had a conversation and he said, San Francisco is a giant homeless encampment, the tents going for blocks and blocks and the smell of urine and feces. It's unbelievable. And of course, here in, I live in Eureka, California, in the Redwood Forest area in the far north, and we have the largest homeless population per capita in California. We have seven times the normal homeless population, and with it comes heroin and meth, rising crime. We have a crime, we have crime similar to Oakland here. This in Oakland are the two crime capitals of California. We also have the distinction of being the city where more pedestrians are run over by automobiles than anywhere in America.
This sounds like it's going to the dogs. So you're heading out of the area to the Midwest, I understand. But before we leave the left coast, I did want to talk with you a little bit about what's going on further north from you in Oregon. Of course, there's the mayhem in Portland that's been going on, but now there's fires over much of the state, as is true in much of California as well. Talk about some reports that we're receiving that they may not be all accidental.
Yes, well, I had an email from a friend up there, and we're just 90 miles from the Oregon border here, that several of the fires were started on the same day and along the main interstate corridor going up and down the state, which is what you would expect. And there are reports there that he has heard from people that he knows that that overheard Antifa people saying, we're going to burn down California. This is what, and then, Antifa people running around to these areas where some of the fires are starting, being seen coming and going from those areas, having left, you know, Portland and some of the cities where they're currently involved. So it sounds like it could be that Antifa is lighting the fires here. And of course, when you get to the end of summer, you know, things are pretty dry out here in the Pacific Northwest, and these trees can be very vulnerable before the start of the rainy season, which generally doesn't begin before October, November, typically.
So, Jeff Nyquist, what we're basically talking about is not just criminal behavior, but it's kind of vandalism on an epic scale, destroying this magnificent forestry of our upper Northwest, as well as the immense amounts of resources and in some cases lives that are lost in the process. To the extent that this kind of activity can be actually attributed to a group like Antifa, this seems to be pretty much consistent with their revolutionary agenda, their violence, their destructiveness. Do you find convincing that one might be able to connect these dots to the group that's being causing so much damage in, well, Portland, Oregon, for sure, one of its most, I gather, concentrated areas of activists in the country, but elsewhere as well?
Well, yes, I do. One of the things that's very difficult is that there's so much fuel for these fires. I understand five towns in Oregon have burned, small towns. And of course, here in California, when we get these brush fires, we've had almost 150 people have died over the last 2 years in these repeated seasonal. You know, I've lived here for more than 50 years in California, and I have never seen year after year these brush fires recurring. And it has to do with environmental policy, but I think that there is some kind of arson going on because this has never happened before. We've never had this level of burning continuously. And this year, for Oregon and California both to be lit up the way they are, it's got to be.
You know, it's interesting, Jeff, as you're talking, half a world away in Israel, another terrorist organization, Hamas, is using inflammable balloons to torch the forests of Israel, of which there are not many because it's such an arid desert, more or less. And yet the Israelis over the years have gone to great lengths and take great pride in their forests. And I don't think they've got the same problem with the environmentalism gone mad that that you've pointed to in California and elsewhere in the United States, where the brush can't be cleared because it's going to impact the environment. Well, their forests are simply burning because the Hamas terrorists are attacking them. And it may well be that Antifa or perhaps others associated with them or acting independent of them, maybe, are engaged in similar kinds of activities in our own country. Jeff, I did want to ask you about one other thing, not in our own country, but still in the region up there. I just learned yesterday that a group in Vancouver, British Columbia, across the border in Canada, called Adbusters, is openly advertising its intention to lay siege to the White House in the United States, and that this may go on for 50 days from the middle of September through the election and perhaps beyond. What are we to make of this? A, that we have a foreign entity announcing publicly its intention in this regard, and the prospects that this may really become a huge new, Chaz kind of operation, to take a page out of the playbook of Antifa and its friends in Portland, or Seattle, I should say. But give us your sense as a serious national security practitioner and analyst. What is this about, and what's the appropriate response to it as you see it?
Well, Vancouver, Canada, has become a major center of Chinese communist activity. A tremendous center. In 1997, there was a joint study done by the Canadian Intelligence Service and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police called the Sidewinder Report. It was classified. I got a hold of a copy of it back in the early 2000s. And it basically said that Canada was being infiltrated through Vancouver by the Communist Chinese, by their crime syndicates in alliance with the People's Liberation Army. And their objective was to use Canada as a highway for attacking America in the flank. This kind of language is to find in it. It had numerous interviews with subjects, Chinese subjects in Canada who became informants of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police of the Canadian Intelligence. And they had warned the Canadian government that the objective of the Chinese was to get control of the Canadian national government, not just regionally over British Columbia, which they were making great strides at. You know, this is 23 years ago now. Well, anyway, the Canadian politicians at the national level suppressed the Sidewinder report and prevented anything from being done. So it just ballooned from there. And so even laws have been passed in Canada enabling the Chinese and their infiltration agents to get in there further. So it's not surprising to me that Vancouver becomes a major base. And there's also stories about the Chinese operating in Indian reservations in Canada. In America, Indian reservations are under the federal government. In Canada, they're almost like independent places where the Chinese have moved a lot of personnel in. So there's some kind of Chinese operation building in British Columbia.
So, Jeff, perhaps there is this tie, and I personally am very much of the view that there is, between the Chinese Communist Party and Antifa, and for that matter, the Black Lives Matter organization. We know they're all trained Marxists, as Patrice Cullors said, one of the leaders of Black Lives Matter. But whether they're foreign-supported, foreign-enabled, foreign-directed, or not. If we have a Canadian group that is talking about occupying territory, especially territory around the home of the President of the United States, clearly for the purposes of intimidating, if not threatening, and otherwise impairing official functions of that very important office complex, this is a national security problem, is it not?
Yeah, if the problem that we have is we don't have effective counterintelligence on our own soil, we don't have effective border control. And of course, you could say the same thing for Mexico and Canada, because similar reports I've heard coming out of Mexico. The United States is extremely vulnerable from its immediate borders. I mean, we've taken for granted that the Northern Hemisphere is sort of our domain, that it's a friendly place, and we've taken that for granted for the country itself too, and it's not.
Jeff Nyquist, this is one of the reasons why we value your visits with us each week. They're chilling, usually, but so insightful and so important. We'll be back to you with more on this next week. Jeff Nyquist, thank you for your time today. Check out his work at jrnyquist.blog. We'll talk with you again next week, Jeff. Next up, we will be speaking with Rochelle Peterson about another angle of attack for the Chinese Communist Party in America, our academic institutions. That and more, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it's a particular delight to say we're joined by one of the women that I have come to admire most for her insights and her clarity and her courage in describing, well, a whole host of topics, really, but most especially for the purposes of our conversations here at Secure Freedom Radio, her insights into what China is doing in the way of what's been called soft power. I call it subversion. Inside our own country, specifically inside our academy. Her name is Rochelle Peterson. She is a senior research fellow at the National Association of Scholars. She is the author of a very important paper that came out about 2 years ago, as I recall, Outsourced: Confucius Institutes and Soft Power in America, which was really a path-breaking book on the subject and has caused a lot of people to think very differently about these Chinese influence operations known as Confucius Institutes. She is also the author of a brand new paper entitled Corrupting the College Board, Confucius Institutes and K-12 Education. Rochelle Peterson, congratulations on this important new paper. I've not had a chance to look at it yet, but I am very anxious to pick your brains about it. But before I do, I thought I'd just sort of set the stage, maybe reprise a little bit some of your previous work and findings about what China is doing in the way of these influence operations inside our country's universities and colleges in particular, but other academic institutions as well.
Well, thank you, Frank. This is a really important topic. China has been aggressively targeting American institutions and trying to work from the inside out, building strategic power and influence from right within the organizations that are shaping our society. At colleges and universities, China is sponsoring Confucius Institutes that teach Americans how to think about China. It's using the Thousand Talents Plan, which is recruiting American professors and researchers to share their intellectual property with China, defrauding the American taxpayers who have funded that research. And then it's working with the College Board and K-12 schools as target lower grades, infiltrating really from the bottom up.
One other group that you didn't mention, but that I think is also of concern, is this Chinese Students and Scholars Association. Could you say a word about it, and how does it operate? What's the division of labor, for example, between these Confucius Institutes and this CSSA, as it's known?
The Chinese Students and Scholars Association is the way the Chinese government seeks to mobilize Chinese nationals living in the U.S. It seeks to keep tabs on Chinese students and professors who may be having fellowships in the U.S. to make sure they are staying aligned with the CCP's principles and that they're turning out for protests and demonstrations and events that show their loyalty towards China. So the Confucius Institutes you can think of as efforts to influence colleges and universities from within. The Chinese Students and Scholars Association you can think of as pressure on the outside executed by Chinese nationals in the U.S. Seeking to push colleges and universities to advance the Chinese communist government's interests.
It's all towards the same end, isn't it? What is the involvement of the Chinese embassy or consulates in this country in these various projects and activities, Rochelle Peterson?
The consulates have been very active. Just last month, the State Department shut down the Houston consulate, saying that Chinese diplomats had been actively engaged in organizing intellectual property theft, that the consulate had itself become a hub for coordinating the theft of American intellectual property. And the consulate is heavily involved in managing these Chinese students and scholars associations, giving them directives, giving them events to plan, orders for when to turn out and protest on such and such a topic. The consulate is heavily involved in these aggressive campaigns.
So in a way, it's not soft power, strictly speaking. It's really the power of the Chinese Communist Party and its government very actively being brought to bear. And it must be said, Rochelle, that one of the ways that they keep these Chinese students and scholars aligned and doing their bidding is that they will threaten their family back in China. People who come to this country, I think it's fair to say, from China to go to school are not only still on the hook, in a manner of speaking, because their families are subject to that kind of pressure, but also they've been selected by the party for this kind of opportunity, have they not?
Yes, China heavily controls the flow of students to the U.S. And selects which students are able to apply. And as you mentioned, those students face immense pressure once they're here to execute the CCP's interests. Their families are on the line back in China. Students have been known to get visits from Chinese diplomats, reminding them to continue to toe the line and advance the CCP's interests. It's really heartbreaking that students coming to America, the home of the free, are even here being tracked by their own authoritarian regime and forced to carry out its wishes.
Let me turn to your new report. And again, we're speaking with Rochelle Peterson of the National Association of Scholars. The College Board has come in for some criticism in recent years because of what it's been doing to sort of manipulate its testing to advance certain social agendas, shall we say, domestically. What's it doing with the Chinese Communist Party that you've found troubling, Rochelle?
The College Board has become deeply corrupted. It is, of course, responsible for the SAT as well as the AP tests that millions of students take every year. It has systematically been revising all of those tests. AP U.S. History has been turned into an anti-American course. AP European History is now taught as the history of oppression by the West. And AP Chinese was actually paid for by the Chinese government and subject to the Chinese Communist Party's influences. The College Board, as this new report is documenting, is deeply, deeply entangled with the Chinese government, operating not just one or two partnerships, but five, six, seven, eight different programs that it operates in the Chinese Communist government, luring in thousands of teachers, students, parents, and lawmakers, and really giving the Chinese government a veneer of credibility by getting to borrow the College Board's respectability and influence.
This is so troubling because it's completely non-transparent, really. And what makes your work so vital, Rochelle, is that you are exposing it to the light of day. But so you're saying that they have, in effect, taken control of these exams. Help us understand how that translates into what these students are actually studying and what these teachers are actually teaching and what kind of impact it's actually having on the long-term, you know, training as well as mastery of the subject by the students in question.
The College Board enabled the Chinese government effectively corner the market on K-12 instruction in Chinese language in the United States. Everywhere you turn for Chinese language instruction, almost every place you can find, the CCP has its hands all over it. And it has the College Board to thank for that. At K-12 schools, There are teachers being shipped over from China, paid by the Chinese government to teach Chinese language through the Chinese guest teacher program or through Confucius classrooms. The College Board is the one that sponsored that. The College Board recruits school districts to sign up for that program. At the high school level, taking the AP tests, which again, thousands of students take every year, the College Board partnered with the Chinese government to design that test. And of course, whatever it gets put on the test is what students study in their classes.
Yeah, this is so the so-called practice of teach to the test, really. It's telling you need to know this for the exam. So it helps really define what these students are exposed to.
Yes. And then to ensure that teachers are teaching to the test, the CCP has created training programs and professional development opportunities for teachers, again, architected by the CCP. And once again, it's the College Board that is co-sponsoring those, recruiting teachers to attend, recruiting school districts to pay for their teachers to engage in these programs. So everywhere you look, the CCP is cornering the market on K-12 Chinese language instruction, and the College Board is the one that made that happen.
This is a fascinating finding and very, very ominous, but particularly troubling because it fits a pattern, Rochelle Peterson, a pattern in which we do not insist on anything remotely like reciprocity with the Chinese for the kinds of openings that we've given them, whether it's in the case of what is being taught to our children and by whom, or whether it's access to our capital markets, or whether it's, you know, any number of other arrangements that their media, their diplomats, until at least fairly recently, have benefited from, that ours in China have never been afforded the opportunity to enjoy, whether it's travel or whether it's, freedom to report or what have you. So what we're constantly reminded of here is that, as Donald Trump has said, repeatedly, in part, this is on us, not the Chinese for taking advantage of us, but that we let them do it. And this end of a non-reciprocal arrangement seems to me to be one of the important takeaways from this particular study entitled Corrupting the College Board, which people can find at NAS.org. Is that right?
Yes, NAS.org.
Wonderful. I commend it to them. And as always, your greater body of work, Rochelle Peterson, thank you for coming and talking with us about it from time to time. I hope you'll do so again soon. It's great to visit with you. Next up, we'll speak with Bobby Charles. We'll talk with him about the military and Donald Trump and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We are joined by Robert Charles, a frequent guest on this program, I'm pleased to say, a former Assistant Secretary of State in the George W. Bush administration. He is also, a very active contributor to the public policy debate, notably in his role as the spokesman for the Association of Mature American Citizens. And you can follow his copious writings there at amac.us. He is also the author of a terrific book, Eagles and Evergreens, and a frequent guest on various media outlets, including, as I said, this one, for which we're very, very appreciative. Bobby Charles, welcome back. Good to have you with us, sir. I wanted to draw you out about this, I think, thoroughly disreputable article in The Atlantic by Jeffrey Goldberg, in which he professed that four different individuals had said the president in 2018 had essentially dissed the United States military and declining to visit a memorial to the cemetery in France. What did you make of this story and both the press reaction to it, and what did you think the military thought of it?
Frank, let me start with the most basic observation, and that is that this is probably the most patriotic president since at least George Herbert Walker Bush, maybe George W. Bush, maybe Ronald Reagan. I won't make comparisons, but this president clearly supports the military. He has done more for veterans than any president I can think of in recent history. And he cares deeply about both the significance of what the military brings to the table, as in the protection of the national security of every American, but about the people themselves. And I'll just say, I think they're reaching around to throw any absurdity they can throw. You know, we're now going to learn, I'm sure, that he's done all sorts of heinous things, because there's nothing that's sticking right now. And so I see this from the most broad perspective as simply not even vaguely credible. And in fact, I think we've got more than 20 people, including John Bolton, who were there at the time speaking up and saying this is just nonsense. So you have intuitively your understanding that this president is a diehard patriot. He actually was a young man. He was at a military school as a very young person. And so then I'm going to go to the bigger picture, which is what the American military personnel think of this president. I think they think for the first time, I mean, if you look back through Obama and beyond, here's a president who doesn't think that their lives should be frivolously thrown at conflicts around the world, but does think that the national security of the country matters, and that their role as people, as a force, both as individuals and as a force, really matters. And everything he has said, from his speeches in Europe and the Middle East to his speeches here at home and his States of the Union, have made crystal clear that he cares about military personnel. So I guess I'll say this. There's a handful of anti-Trump military personnel, no doubt, and retired, who, for their own personal reasons, I'm sure, whether it's social engineering or something else, they don't like what this president is doing. Having said that, the vast, vast majority of veterans out there that I talk to and have talked to are 110% in this president's corner, because they know where his heart is. And at the end of the day, you can have all the Atlantic articles in the world, and Atlantic themselves are backing away from that anonymous sourced article now. But this is just an effort to sully the reputation of a man who has clearly stood his ground. And I guess Americans, both in and out of the military, appreciate the lone man standing his ground on principle.
Just on those former generals, when you talk about the gaggle of them now that have come forward and really quite vociferously denounced this president, it seems to me it says something about them as a class, as the product of, you know, a promotion system, you're very familiar with it, of course, that was politically rewarding people who had the right attitudes on policy that went along with the Obama-Biden program, for example, whether it was gays in the military or whether it was transgenders or simply hollowing out the military. Some of them served in combat with distinction, but they certainly seem to have been rewarded for fidelity to a line that's obviously very different than Donald Trump's. Do you think that's at work here, Bobby Charles?
I do. I let me say three things. First, the American military is truly a reflection of the best in American society. And that means that there is a tolerance within the personhood of each other. I knew friends that were Democrats when I was an officer. I knew friends who were Republicans. I knew friends who felt just about everywhere on the political spectrum. And the attitude that we all had was, we serve one great country. Our job is to assign that page to, put our lives up there, and go do whatever it is that we have to do in our time to be equal to our time. And that's all. And sometimes what we did in the case of me was not very significant. I did my job for 10 years, and that was it. I had a full heart, and I don't doubt for one second that everybody I served with had a full heart at that time, dedicated to the proposition that we were there to help preserve, protect, and defend this wonderful country. So number one, very diverse. Happens that when they retire, they get to speak. When you're in the military, you really don't get to speak politically. So maybe some of them percolate up afterwards. Number two, the officer corps has, I mean, all I have to do is read a couple of the books. The Generals is a great book, you know, about the fact that we had very few generals in World War II, and they were most of them combat experienced. We have a great many general officers today, and many of them are not, haven't spent any time in combat. So there is this tendency, I think I'll call it, you know, rank inflation, that has definitely changed the frame of reference. It's also increased the number of senior officers as well as junior officers. We had a blip in the middle, but it was you know, the increase is there. Third, to your point about politics, yes, I think that you know, if you live and breathe long enough a certain kind of air, you begin to think that's the only air there is to breathe. And I think, you know, and I think if the air is contaminated with politics, which the Obama administration did everything from naming ships after, you know, really nefarious characters and unnaming ships after people who were quite distinguished to trying the social engineering bit, you know, I think we have to always just back off three paces and remember that the people who are in uniform right now are really the only ones that are really on the front lines. It's not the retired officer corps. It's the folks that are right there right now. And I think they, by and large, talking to those that are in uniform, think this president is supporting them superbly. He cares about everything from the events that bring him to Arlington to the events that bring him to other parts of the world. And I see absolutely no change in this president's summer when it comes to caring about the military and caring about our veterans. So those who see a chink, I think they want to see a chink, and that's it.
I spoke earlier in the program with Jeff Nyquist about this bizarre situation. It's the only way I can think to describe it, of a group in Canada, perhaps with active involvement of Chinese Communist Party figures that are much in evidence there, perhaps not, but either way, that have made known their intent to mount a siege of the White House for 50 days, starting next week. This seems to be untoward, to say the least. The president has the authority under something called the Insurrection Act, as you know, to forcibly, if necessary, disperse people who might be engaged in such an activity. But while there may be other ways to do this, it might require uniformed personnel of the United States military. And there has been some evident reluctance on the part of the senior leadership to perform such a role if called to do so. What are your thoughts about that?
You know, I guess I think get spun up a little less than other people. I think there are always nefarious groups out there trying to do damage. And if you go back to the 1960s, there was a period of time when the White House was surrounded by buses in order to protect it against mobs that were definitely trying to do damage. I don't underestimate, and I believe the Secret Service is probably all over this. I have no inside knowledge. There is a gradation of escalation. We do this one rung at a time. And if for some reason local police can't handle it and the federal law enforcement community can't handle it, then they lean on the National Guard. Typically, although in Washington would, I guess, be under presidential authority, but typically under a governor's Title 32 authority, and then you crank it up as it, in the event, and the Insurrection Act has been used in modern history, in the event that it was required to turn back some sort of military event, we could mobilize them. You know, I want to make one last point on today's show, and it's this, Frank. We are a truly great country, and maybe it is in moments like this week, 19th anniversary of 9/11, that we need to sit back and just pause for a moment and recognize how absolutely unique this nation is. I honestly volunteered for active duty on 9/11. I was never more purposeful. I was sad, but I was also very purposeful, and I think a great many Americans feel that way.
Thank you, Bobby, for making that point so well. We appreciate you so much. Thank you for joining us this week. We'll look forward to talking with you in the near future, and I hope talking to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.